They're trying to pull the white voters away, the white voters in the Fusion Party, away from the black voters, right? They want to break that up. How do they do it? They institute race, all right? They use the media. Now, the media back then, you know, when there was no social media, there wasn't television, the newspaper was the number one media vehicle in the world, okay? Every person read the newspaper. So what did they do? They used the newspaper to talk about what would happen, to scare people, what would happen with African Americans running the county, running the town, okay? Negro rule. We can't have that, all right? Not only that, most of the people, I don't say most, but there was a lot of people who were illiterate. They couldn't read. So what did they do? They used pictures, all right? Pictures that in terms of showing black people as like gorillas.
We'll discuss race and how it plays a factor and how we didn't even talk about this topic because we were afraid.
A Black Executive Perspective.
Welcome to a Black Executive Perspective podcast, a safe space where we discuss all matters related to race, especially race in corporate America. I'm your host, Tony Tidbit.
And I'm your co-host, Chris P. Reed.
So, Chris, real quick, you're from Peoria, Illinois. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. So I just want to make sure we had the same type of education growing up. So when I went to grade school in Detroit, our history lessons often highlighted the principles of democracy. We were taught about a government free from dictatorial rule because we had a three-party system where each branch ensured checks and balances. Was that the same thing that you were taught in Peoria?
Absolutely the same thing.
Okay. And then we also learned that this system was designed to uphold the will of the people, emphasizing that every vote was crucial and that following the electoral process, democracy would triumph. Is anything different in Peoria versus Detroit?
It's the exact same thing so far. We're on the same page.
Okay. And then also, you know, me and my classmates were told that only nations lacking democratic foundations could governments be overthrown. Yet throughout our lessons, there was no mention of the events in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. Did you hear anything about Wilmington, North Carolina when you were growing up?
Nothing at all. Didn't even know anything at all about Wilmington as a place until this year recently. And some of the things we're going to end up getting into.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, so this must have been an oversight in our history lessons. However, learning about Wilmington has really shaken my belief in the democracy that we've been told about from the onset. So today, Chris and I will delve into the history of Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898, revealing a time when democracy failed to uphold its promise. We'll explore the events that unfolded, the consequences that ensued, and discuss the potential for such a situation to reoccur in the future. So we're going to go right into this, but one of the things that we recommend that you do, pick up the book called Wilmington's Lie by David Shichino. All right. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. All right. Book came out in 2020. Very unknown, so I would definitely pick that up, and you can follow along. So look, let's don't waste any time. Let's jump into it.
For a long time, if you went to the library in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was one thing you weren't allowed to research.
We were refused. We were rejected by the librarian.
When I asked about or inquired about 1898, they wanted to know why.
I was told that, yes, they had something, but they kept it under lock and key.
The story of Wilmington in 1898 still isn't widely known. This is the story of an American election, but also of something we don't usually find in American history. The violent overthrow of a democratically elected government.
So, I mean, let's just think about what she said. She said, this is the story of an American situation where there was a violent overthrow of a democratically elected government. And interestingly enough, the author of Wilmington's Lie is not an apologist, nor is he a historian. He's a journalist. Like you said, four-time Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist. And so the things that he uncovered here. He had to go in deep with his journalistic background and actually find these things because they didn't want them to be uncovered so easily. You had to have a professional, you know, come in and make sure that these things came to light. And it's so interesting that something so heinous and, you know, vile could occur on our soil. And me even having a degree in history, being a historian, you know, it goes from 1865 before and then modern history. This is 1898 and I'd never heard of it. Now, and so that makes it even more intriguing to me to lean in on something like this.
Yeah, not only you never heard of it, you heard in the clip, the people that live in Wilmington, all right? They were going to the library saying, hey, we hear this thing called Wilmington's like 1898. What? What are you talking about? What? Wilmington, what? 1898? We got stuff on 1899. We got stuff on 1897, but we don't got nothing. So they were trying to hide it purposely, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's a reason. So let's keep moving, all right, so we can learn more about Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898.
In the late 1800s, Wilmington, North Carolina was the state's largest city. It had a majority Black population, and historians today describe it as a rarity in the post-Civil War American South.
Wilmington, prior to November 1898, was what the New South could be at the cusp of the 20th century.
There was an unusual degree of Black prosperity.
In Wilmington, there were successful Black entrepreneurs, doctors, teachers, but also Black elected officials. And for a time, that was true throughout the state.
So, Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898, largest city in North Carolina. Today is Charlotte, okay? A mixed race population, okay? One of the things about Wilmington, which was different in the South, because this is 33 years after the Civil War, okay? And I believe 32 years after the 13th Amendment that freed slaves, okay? So now this is a city in the South where people are living together, majority Black population, over 100 Black government officials that live in Wilmington. So think about this. You're going from slavery, now Black people are now in politics. They're in leadership position, city councilman, city clerk, the treasurer, city attorney. There are also Black congressmen from Wilmington and also that represented the state of North Carolina. 56% of the Wilmington population was Black. It was mixed with white people working together, all right? There were successful Black businesses, okay, from the African-American newspaper, The Record, all that stuff, positive stuff. This was the jewel of the South to show that through Reconstruction, how a city of mixed race, Black and white people working together, but not just working together, leading the city from a political standpoint could be Civil War,
and even with that, with it being a port city, it has shipping and commerce, merchants. They had teachers and postmasters and everything. And really, it had the opportunity to epitomize what could be. When the guy said it was an unusual amount of Black prosperity, that's interesting because there was zero Black prosperity 15 years prior. So it might not have been unusual because it was new. And this is how it could be if we allow for it to do so. So that was really intriguing to me when he made that comment. And I think that it's what could have been for the entire United States. But we'll see, you know, how things change when things change.
Exactly. And the one thing, there were 125,000 Black people that were registered to vote in Wilmington, North Carolina. So please write that down as we continue to move forward. Let's go, Double A.
The Democratic and Republican parties of 1898 in many ways occupied opposite parts of the political spectrum than they do today.
Most African Americans were voting for the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party was white voters almost exclusively. White supremacy was the central focus of the platform for the Democratic Party.
Republicans in North Carolina were successful in part because of a third party called the Populist Party, made up of mostly white farmers fed up with the tough economic times. North Carolina populists joined up with Republicans to form what they called the Fusion Party statewide. That meant North Carolina now had a government that shared power between black and white politicians, including a newly elected Republican governor. Together, they moved towards reforms that would favor black Americans and working class whites.
This was something that the Democratic Party folks were simply not going to accept.
So let's think about this. The Fusion Party, which is comprised of working class individuals who have a common struggle, which just so happened to be black folks at that time, was against what was the Democratic Party at that point, which was, as she stated, the white supremacy party. It was all white. It was the Democratic Party at that time. Things have changed since then, and that's a different pod for us to get into. But it was interesting to me, and even as I said, going down the annals of history, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, which is weird to have him do the Emancipation Proclamation and be a Republican, but that was co-opted at some point. We'll talk about co-opting and things like that in a different podcast. But the design was people who had similar interests and who represented the majority of the population decided that, hey, these Democrats are backing the railroads and the banks and the big money, and they're not thinking about the interest of the people as a whole. They're not thinking about the Commonwealth. They're thinking about their own interests and their own, you know, corrupted sensibilities, and we can't have that. So the Fusion Party was formed from the populists, where all of the working class stiffs got together and decided to do something. And we're not just talking specifically about Wilmington at this point. We're talking about the entire state of North Carolina. She said the governor of North Carolina was a Fusionist member. This is very, very important that we understand this whole state had an opportunity and was embracing it for collective governing, for democracy to reign, for Americans, newly established Americans after the Emancipation Proclamation, to all coexist, cohabitate, and thrive in this environment. And that's what was at stake here, that they were all friends. They were all coming together for the common good of the Commonwealth.
Excellent point, buddy. Excellent point. And the one final thing that she said at the end of the clip, they had policies that favored black Americans and working white Americans. So again, remember that point, all right? Because at the end of the day, to Chris's point, these groups come together. Our interest is your interest, okay? And because they come together, they're able to create a political base that is strong, that is benefiting both groups, right? So please remember that as we move forward. Let's keep rolling.
A multiracial government wasn't just a disappointment for Democrats. It was more like a humiliation. They needed a plan to take back control of the state in the next election. Alfred Moore Waddell came up with one: to beat the Fusion Party by luring white populist voters away from their alliance with black voters. Wilmington, with a large black population and a local fusion government in power, would be a focus of their campaign.
So you can see here, the Democrats, they're not going for that, okay? And when we say Democrats, let's be clear here, okay? Because, the word is interchangeable today, but it means two different things, all right? The Democrats, as Chris was talking about, was the white supremacy group, okay? They believed in slavery. They're the ones that instituted segregation and Jim Crow and all this type of stuff. So just be clear here. And going back to where black people voted at the time, they voted Republican because Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves and he was a Republican. Okay? So let's be clear. They wasn't going to have this, right? These are people where a generation ago they were slaves. They didn't have rights. And the one thing that really, makes it, the one thing that white people at the time couldn't deal with is that as they looked at black people was beneath them. Okay, so now these individuals have political power. They're running a city. And then some of the policies benefit them, where 30-something years ago, there was no black people that was running anything. There was no policies benefiting them. They wasn't working together with working class white people. So the Democrats was like, we're not having this. And one of the things we've always talked about on this podcast, and one of the strategies that still apply today, is called divide and conquer. So this was their plan. Their plan was, number one, we can't have this. Number two, we got to lure the white working class, part of the fusion government, away from the black people, right? So we can then be able to take power, all right? That was their goal, and that was their plan.
Yeah, and I mean, and they were not coming off of that. As you stated, they wanted it the way they wanted to make it great again, and the way that they had seen it so far, they couldn't comprehend anything else, and they were unwilling to evolve. And that's the thing about the lack of perspective and the lack of being able to embrace something that's already been established. The danger in it is these were things that were legally mandated, constitutionally applied, and it just didn't resonate with a subset of folks. And these were the supremacist party, and they actually had a platform to support some of their views. And that's where it got really dangerous.
And here's the kicker. They were voted in. It was free election. Everybody had a right to vote. Everybody campaigned, okay? And they lost, all right? So instead of just saying, you know what, we lost this one, they lost in 1894 and they lost in 1896, all right? So they had lost the last two elections. So instead of saying, you know, we gotta get a better political strategy, right? They wasn't having it. So now they're looking forward to create a plan to take over. Let's move on, Double A.
The State Democratic Party Handbook for 1898 laid out their goal: consolidate the white vote by stoking white anger and resentment. It said, this is a white man's country and white men must control and govern it.
Grapes don't get less sour over time, Tony. You know what I'm saying? When you got sour grapes, you got sour grapes. But the fact is, they used the Democratic Party to represent and reinforce that America is white. And they will never not believe America is white, to the point where they documented, published, and distributed a handbook to reinforce these things openly. We're not talking about like a shadow public government. We're not talking about behind the scenes and Illuminati type stuff. We're not talking about none of that. We're talking about, hey, I believe and I'm so convicted to what I think about this country being what I believe it to be, that I'm going to make sure that I, you know, say it from the rooftops and print this out and produce this and give it to as many people as are willing to ingest it as possible. And that is the most dangerous thing they could have done, because unfortunately, that's how we know about this now, I guess fortunately, but unfortunate that they were so comfortable in their belief system, in their ideology, that they knew what they were doing with all their heart and souls was right, and they were willing to kill for it. I don't know if they were willing to die for it, but they was willing to kill for it to make sure that it remained as it has always been.
Yeah, I mean, look, this wasn't, you know, something that they wrote on a napkin.
Right.
Or was on the top of their head. They created a handbook.
It wasn't right? Whispers. It wasn't whispers in the back room.
Whispers through, you know, this wasn't my girl saying, rumor has it.
Yes,
you know, she's singing the song, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't none of that. This was a handbook that they wrote out, okay, flat out. That was public, right. Okay? Flat out public, all right? So let's see now exactly what's their next point of attack.
Their most effective tool was the media. One of North Carolina's biggest newspapers was a Democratic Party mouthpiece. It ran racist political cartoons throughout 1898. Many of the cartoons were centered on the threat of Negro rule, even though the fusion government was mostly white. They also played up another fear.
Black men threatening white women became a theme. White men need to do all that they can to protect white womanhood.
This was all part of North Carolina Democratic strategy, but it echoed the national racist rhetoric of the time. In one speech that Democrats printed in a Wilmington paper, a prominent Georgia writer named Rebecca Felton said,
"If it takes lynching a black man a day to protect white womanhood, I say lynch."
It was just a few months before the election, and white voters were angry.
So, think about it now. What are they looking to do? They're trying to pull the white voters away, the white voters in the Fusion Party, away from the black voters, right? They want to break that up. How do they do it? They institute race, all right? They use the media. Now, the media back then, you know, when there was no social media, there wasn't television, the newspaper was the number one media vehicle in the world, okay? Every person read the newspaper. So what did they do? They used the newspaper to talk about what would happen, to scare people, what would happen with African Americans running the county, running the town, okay? Negro rule. We can't have that, all right? Not only that, most of the people, I don't say most, but there was a lot of people who were illiterate. They couldn't read. So what did they do? They used pictures, all right? Pictures that in terms of showing black people as like gorillas, and you don't want that as your person that's leading your town. You don't want that. They're gonna kill you. And then the key thing is that they went after and said, our white women are going to be raped. They're going to be taken over. So they use that as a way to be able to get white people afraid. And look, it was so effective. One of the, what was her name? Her name was Alexander, not Alexander Mann, the woman who wrote Georgia. The thing. I forget her name. But she wrote an article saying, well, look, if it's talking about saving white women, and if we're talking about lynching a black man every day, then I say lynch. All right? So immediately their strategy is working. Because now these people, the white people who are part of the fusion government, now is starting to get afraid and they're starting to become angry.
And so, as she stated, the fusion government, as far as the representatives, were comprised of mostly white folks. We just had a sprinkle or two of black folks in the government positions. So it wasn't that this is completely owned and operated and run by black folks and it just had went off the rails. It was a co-opt of black people and white people, majority white people. But when they use the demonization of black folks in these cartoons, and they're reaching their more base audience, which was illiterate. And we know from Emmett Till to so many different instances of the offense or the sanctity of the pure white woman is a dog whistle to make sure that we can't have this, because we got to protect the white woman overall. We got to make sure that her purity, her chastity, all these things are so of an incendiary type of dynamic that we make sure that this gets people on board. That fear, like you said, using race as a weapon was cultivated and forged at this point in time. This is the proving grounds to really try to make sure that we don't continue to progress forward, but that we actually separate ourselves even further, but not only making black people property, but now criminalizing, we talked about
there's
this.
No question.
In a certain context, now we're criminalizing people because of skin tone. Americans, because of skin tone. We're criminalizing them and castigating them into a subset that is subhuman and seen as a threat in all phases. Like you said, doctors, lawyers, postmasters, people who are educated and well-spoken and well-dressed, and families are now, it doesn't matter. If you have this skin tone, you don't belong and you can... You know, you're a threat. Not only do I just not want you over there, I want you to be eliminated and seen as less than by everybody around. Because for whatever reason, they've fallen for your tricks. And now we have this fusion party. And now things are working for the majority. But for the ones that were left out, they couldn't take it.
And
they were
going to
do something about it.
And here's the thing. The power of race. Mm-hmm. Think about that for a second. Here's two groups of people that come together who have the same interests, all right? They're working together. They're voting together because of the policies that's going to benefit both groups. But then as soon as you throw race in the mix, all of a sudden, they're gone. All of a sudden, their racial fears become to the forefront. All of a sudden, the person that you saw as my fellow American, my neighbor, okay, now they're going to kill us. They're going to take our women. We can't be controlled by them. all because of the power of race. So let's see how far this goes. Let's see what happens next on Election Day.
By the time the election rolls around on November 8th, Black voters, Republican voters, had been thoroughly intimidated here.
By all accounts, the elections of 1898 were a sham. The Democratic Party had a paramilitary group called the Red Shirts. They attacked and blocked Black residents from voting. At a rally just before the election, Alfred Moore Waddell provoked the crowds. He said, "Negro office holding ought at once and forever be brought to an end, even if we have to choke the current of the Cape Fear River with carcasses." The votes were counted, and the Democrats won.
Democratic candidates won every seat they had a candidate up for election in.
So the Democrats prevailed in this regard, but let's just go back just a little bit. In 1896, they lost to the Fusion Party. They actually went through the steps of taking it to the North Carolina Supreme Court to rebuke the findings and rebuke the election and say it was stolen and things of that nature. And the Supreme Court threw it out. They tossed it out. So they tried to go the civil route to make sure that this wrong was righted legally. But the court findings said that there was no malfeasance, there was no corruption. This was actually the way democracy worked as intended. Unfortunately, they didn't like that answer. So therefore, they went on a smear campaign and a fear campaign to not privately, not secretly. This is the worst kept secret. They were determined by all means to make sure this never happens again. By any means, we're going to intimidate, provide whatever things that we need to not allow for these folks to get into where people were withdrawing. Good white fusionists were withdrawing their names from the ballot. They were blocking the polls. They were turning people away through violent means to where the 125,000 registered voters, not all of them made it this time, right? There was reasonings behind, and this was a calculated and well thought out, well planned, well executed strategy to keep the Black vote away and to keep the apologist, is what they were called, apologist or the sympathist or the fusionist vote down, because people just didn't want that smoke. They didn't want those problems. Why would I have to go through all this to live in a society, to operate in a society? Well, they were determined to make sure through armed intimidation, through tactics, to swell the vote in their favor, and it worked throughout the state. It worked in every place, and it actually worked to a large degree in Wilmington. There was just one caveat to that that we'll learn about.
Yeah, exactly, though, buddy. But just even to talk about some of the tactics, right? Mm-hmm. And we talked about this in our early episode that we did, not to protect and serve, right? Who did they use, okay, to be able to suppress the Black vote? The police, mm-hmm. Okay? During the campaign, white police rode into Black homes, whipping Black men, and threatened them with death for attempting to vote. Okay, so think about that, the terror, all right, that there is no recourse. You can't go to law enforcement. Law enforcement is part of the issue, okay? So, of course, they were going to win the election. Who's going to stop them from doing what they're doing? But to your point, let's see what the results came in at.
And, of course, the election did nothing to undo the economic power Black folks held in the city. The Democrats had won the election, but their goal of total white supremacist control remained out of reach.
And so they engineered what was essentially a coup d'etat.
The day after the election, at a gathering for white men in Wilmington, the Democrats unveiled a document called the White Declaration of Independence. It contained an ultimatum. Cynthia Brown, whose descendants were in Wilmington back in 1898, is a historian at her church, where there's a preserved copy of the declaration from the next day's newspaper.
"We will no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin."
They would strip Black men of voting rights. They would give white men a large part of the employment heretofore given to Black men.
So they won the election, right? Because Black people didn't show up to vote. However, they still didn't, you know, complete their overall goal, right, was to squash the economic power of the Black American, right? Because there were still people who owned stuff, who owned businesses. And then not everybody that was in political power was up, their office wasn't up for vote at that time frame, right? So what did they do? And Chris, you spoke about this earlier, right? This wasn't like a secret meeting, right? Absolutely. Where, you know, they went in the back room and it was like Maxwell Smart and, you know, secret right. doors opened up. Right. All right? Right. They wrote this out, the White Declaration of Independence. All right. Yes. Cynthia Brown, who you heard, her church has the document. Okay. And it says, we will no longer be ruled by black men. Okay. Mm-hmm. It talks about also about any jobs that come up, they would not be given to black men. They would only be given to white people. This is where you started segregation. All right. That's right. So this was their strategy. It was out. Everybody knew about it, written down. And the goal was to squash black people, to make sure, like they said, this is a country for white people, and only white people are going to run it.
And what they stated was total white supremacy. So to the point where the Spanish-American War is going on at this time, and they pull troops from the Spanish, they pull white supremacist troops that are Republican troops, Democratic troops from the Spanish-American War. And this was the Wilmington Light Infantry and the Wilmington Naval Reserves, and had them come and act out and be armed in the streets to make sure that these things went according to plan. So it was a big, big to do. And once again, not a secret, not something that snuck up on folks, even to the point where, and you say, okay, wait a second, if it wasn't a secret, what was the black folks doing? What was going on? And also that at that time, blacks were then denied the right to arm themselves, and the black soldiers who were equipped and understood how to use a weapon were away at the Spanish-American War. So these black folks that were there and were voting were in essence exposed. And it was a great plan. But keep in mind, we're talking about the election was on the 8th. This is the day later next they're day, not satisfied.
The next day. Right. And here's the thing, though. Black people knew what was coming. Right. OK. They didn't have no recourse. Right. OK. Either you run or you try to stand your ground, which they tried to stand their ground. OK. So that's the they wasn't like shocked. Because mm-hmm. this was, to your point, this was written out in the open. They knew what was coming, right? But are you just going to give up everything that you worked hard for? Let's see what happens.
At City Hall, the mayor and Board of Aldermen were forced out.
There's 200 armed men in City Hall at the time. They didn't do it of their own free will. And as they resigned, a new member selected by the Democratic Party was voted into office.
Waddell, who once threatened to fill the Cape Fear River with black bodies, was the new mayor of Wilmington. Meanwhile, the mob had grown to about 2,000 men, and the violence spilled into the streets.
And there are varying stories about how many people were killed.
I see 40 to 60 clearly as fatalities as a result of the violence, but I think it was higher.
Many black residents hid for days in the swamps and the wooded cemeteries in the city, including Cynthia's great-grandmother. And thousands of other residents fled Wilmington, never to return.
So these armed individuals ran the black folks, tried to kill them if they could, but at least ran them out of their homes, their properties, their businesses, their churches, everything they could, to absolve Wilmington of black people that they could get rid of. And the white ones that were in charge, they took their office, did a sham election and voted people in, you know, instantaneously. And then also led those folks, the apologists, the lovers of black folks to the edge of town, put them on a train at gunpoint and told them, if you ever come back here, we will kill you on sight. So they absolutely took the population, and just to know from historical reference, at that time, Wilmington was 56% black. Today, it's 18% black. So it actually had repercussive actions for centuries. Absolutely. So this was so calculated, so cold, so bold, but once again, not a secret, and very, very aggressive. Because there's one report that says, of the 60 plus people that were killed, only two were not shot in the back. So as these people were fleeing and trying to save their families, and this is men, women, and children. This is not just black men being gunned down. This is black people, American citizens that are being gunned down by American citizens and soldiers in the streets of Wilmington, North Carolina.
And you said it earlier, buddy. Legally, they tried to fight the election of 1894, 1896. Supreme Court says, no, there's nothing here. So guess what? They do it by violence. A coup d'etat. And see, this is what we're talking about when we talked about growing up and learning about our government and learning that, you know, our democracy is pure. Our democracy is the pillar of our foundation. Our country is set up with three branches of government to provide checks and balances. You only have countries that are third world that, you know, you have overthrows, coup d'etats. You know, somebody just come in and they kill the president and they just take over the country. Like what's happening in Haiti right now, right?
Right.
To be fair, okay? This doesn't happen here in the United States. It did. And the thing about it, none of us learned anything about this. Nobody talked about it, okay? But you have people today walking around draped in American flag and talking about the sanctity of our Constitution and, you know, how we're the greatest country on the planet and we protect and all these things. And here is a city that was overthrown, a government thrown out, okay, by violence. People were killed. People lost their life savings. Their wealth, generational wealth, is gone. Okay, because they didn't like who was running it, and here's the thing. This was in a state, all right. Because to be fair, everybody in the state saw this coming, all right. Because they had went to the Supreme Court. The governor was part of the fusion party, okay, of North Carolina. So at the end of the day, this ain't a secret. And nobody, no federal troops came in. Matter of fact, who was the president?
McKinley.
McKinley. You said it earlier, right? The president knew what they were going to do.
Absolutely.
They were trying to get him to send federal troops. And he was like, nah, I don't want to do that to take away from the Spanish American. So this was wide open. So this is not a secret. This is all the way up to the federal level.
Yep.
People knew that this was happening.
Yep. This is now, as you say this, what came into my mind is this may go down. We might have to write a book, Tony, the greatest heist in the history of America, because they stole the American dream.
Flat out.
They took these people's livelihood. They took everything these black folks had known for the last 30 some odd years and literally stole the American dream, because Wilmington was the American dream.
For everyone, right? It was the jewel of the South. This is what America is about. Slave man now is mayor, okay? Yep. Congressman. Yep. These people now have the opportunity. They're dentists. They're teachers. And white and black people working together. You kidding me here? You kidding me, right? And because they didn't want that, all right, all of a sudden this happened and then it was hidden. So let's keep going on. Let's keep moving.
The city never regained its black majority population. Jim Crow laws like literacy tests and poll taxes that prevented black people from voting were immediately enacted, and Wilmington's spirit of black opportunity was crushed. Black political representation in the state was over. It would be 90 years until North Carolina elected its next black Congress member.
I mean, you talking about just wipe... So think about it for a second. We talk about systemic racism. That's what this is, okay? So immediately when they take over, what do? They institute Jim Crow laws, okay? So now all of a sudden, black people can't vote. What happened, I told you guys earlier, it was 125,000 registered voters in 1898. That went all the way down to 6,000 3 years later, okay? Think about that for a second. So now, economic progress wiped out. separate but equal, which we know is not equal, is now implemented. Okay? Now, 90 years before another person of color wins political office, think about that for a second. Okay? The city never regained, Chris spoke about it, never regained their black majority. It was 56%. Now it's 18%. So all the opportunity for black people is gone.
Absolutely. And more overarching is, from a Southern perspective, from how we see history now in retrospect, this is the beginning of segregation and separation, as you call the political divide. This is the beginning of the essence of divide and conquer, because the conquest has occurred. And the idea of they enacted laws, small laws in North Carolina, where you couldn't ride on public transportation with a black person. You couldn't eat with a black person. This is where all that stuff that we know from the civil rights era came about. This was the inception of those things, because there was harmony between the blacks and the whites. There was some cohesiveness. There was a situation where relationships were developing, romantic and otherwise. And the idea of, if I'm around you and I work with you and I'm listening to you, I can sympathize for you. I can empathize for you. When I see the cartoons, if I work side by side with a white dude and I see something, I'm like, that ain't Bill. That ain't Tad. You know what I mean? But when I make laws to where we separate these folks, they can't go to church together. They can't be seen together. There's an apartheid type of structure. Now everything I know of you is what I hear of you. And these campaigns continued in the news. These bad stories of the black beast and things of that nature, and the infringing on white society and making sure that they don't get what we have and what we've gotten as manifest destiny and our God-given rights. All of that stuff proliferated, not only in North Carolina for sure, but throughout the South. And that was the beginning of what we now know as U.S. history, or what we've accepted as U.S. history. But it all was cultivated at this point in time. This is the powder keg. This is the moment where they got away with it. And we're like, oh my gosh, to the point where the eventual governor of Georgia, a guy named Hoke Smith, actually, when he was running to try to suppress the black vote and suppress the Republican interest, reached out to these folks for consultation. How do you get these N-words out of there?
He wanted a strategy. You wanted
the Absolutely. Strategy, right? There the was a strategy. Plan? What's the systemic input that I can interact to make sure that I end up like you guys, where we've squashed all this? And that's the danger. That's the saddest part about this story to me, was once again, they killed the American dream for black folks. And they established something that was allowed by the government. And I understand Wilson, you know, was distracted by the Span-Am War. But also, once he saw this stuff getting sedentary and the votes being dropped, Wilson was elected in large part because of the black vote. So when he's saying that his voters were going away from 125 in just this area to 6, he was like, well, I'm losing my voters anyway. I'm not going to, or not Wilson, I'm sorry, McKinley.
McKinley.
Apologize for any historian there. But McKinley, and I think McKinley ended up being assassinated, if I don't, but that's a whole nother story. But the moral of the story is, this was all part of something that was allowed to flourish.
There's no
and
question.
They should have never allowed for it. I don't think they realized the overarching repercussions that we still live with today, but they let this go, and it only encouraged it and reinforced it.
Well, see, that's where I disagree with you, okay? I think they knew the repercussions, okay? I think they didn't care. All right, you got to recognize, for centuries, white people ruled black people.
Right.
Okay, let's just be fair here. Let's say what it is, okay? And then 30-something years, not 200 years later, 30-something years later, black people are prospering. Okay, and this is the thing. People don't recognize this. After the Civil War, after slavery, black people were like, look, let bygones be bygones.
Absolutely.
Let us just go do our thing.
Absolutely.
And they were doing their thing.
Absolutely.
They were doing it, and they didn't want that, okay? Yeah. Because it made them feel like they were less than, okay? Mm-hmm. That's the issue. So it wasn't like they didn't think of the repercussions. They didn't care about the repercussions.
Okay.
They, again, when you don't see your fellow brother and sister as equal, mm-hmm. and you see them as inferior, you don't care about their generations moving forward. All you care about is yourself. All you care about you and yours. And that's what this was about, okay? It's not that the local community, you know, devised this plan and came up with it and kept it secret and nobody knew about it. It was all the way up to the federal. Everybody knew. And they did nothing. And then not only that, Let's move to the next clip. What did they do after AA?
Wilmington did a really great job of covering up a very dark past for a very long time.
Over the years, the textbooks on North Carolina's history have struggled to accurately describe what happened in 1898. This one from 1933 says the situation was unfortunate for both races. And this one from 1978 doesn't have that much more detail. But they both praise Charles Aycock, a politician who helped perpetrate the riot. They say he had a keen mind and a kind heart, and that, in fact, he was one of the best friends that the colored people had in the state. It's a legacy that North Carolina has yet to fully undo. The names of the perpetrators are on Wilmington school buildings and city parks.
So in the preservation of white supremacy and the fear of the Black planet, right? So with the fear of the Black planet, these folks end up in a situation where they are now recast as heroes, recast as saviors of the society. And ironically, it kind of bothered me when she said he was seen as or noted as friend of the colored folks or whatever. I don't know who was surveyed there, but I would challenge that if it was ever, you know, documented anywhere that he was known.
She was reading out of the textbooks. This is what they wrote in the history books. You see what I'm saying? They rewrote the history. So she was reading, if you see the video, she was at the library.
Reading the books that they
rewrote and said, he was the best friend of the colored man. Okay? Absolutely. That's what she was saying.
Absolutely. And that, you know, the crazy part about that is whether it's the statues or the football stadiums at UNC or any of these things and these Confederate ties or these ties to separation, regardless of who you sided with, sometimes these type of things where you actively were involved in this type of violent behavior, you actively promoted and propagated this type of violence against fellow Americans, that's a totally different thing than political ideology.
Correct.
As it relates to I vote for this person or vote for that person.
Correct.
Now you're rabble rousing, you're out lynching, you're out making this acceptable to act this way against fellow Americans. And these folks who had platforms, who had fancy jobs and good educations, was doing this openly to the point where they were then rewarded for their efforts and their behaviors and the things that they presented by giving them names on things and rewritten, as you stated, in the whole annals of history.
And that's the thing, nobody. They're now heroes. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're on kindergarten. They're on schools. Their names mm-hmm. are on schools. Mm-hmm. They have statues. Okay, and these guys, they murdered people. They overthrew a government, mm-hmm. which, to be fair, is treasonous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they should be treason. So that's the issue here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
that's the issue, and the majority of Americans know nothing about it. But they're walking around with their American flag talking about democracy and how we're different than everybody else. And where this was perpetrated to, let's be fair here. Yes, there was a lot of white Americans, but the real reason why they did this was because of the Black Americans. Let's just 100%. Be fair. Okay? 100%. There's been a lot of communities where a group was in power and they ain't like it and, you know, they live with it, right? They may have went to the Supreme Court and it was overturned or it wasn't overturned. They just dealt with it, right?
Right.
They didn't do that here. This was this was a massacre, okay?
Right.
Because they were Black.
Good term.
That's just the bottom line. And then they became heroes, okay? We know they're not, but to be fair, they're heroes in those communities because their name. Let me ask you a question. What criminal, what murderer has a street name after him?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
What murderer has a school name after him? Okay. Right. I mean, maybe there's some. I don't know, but I would doubt
it. Not federally funded. Tony. Okay? Not federally funded institutions.
Not federally funded or town state funded.
So state funded. Right.
Stop.
Right.
The bottom line is, let's call it what it is, okay? Exactly what it is. And anybody listening to this should get upset about it, okay? I don't care if you're Black, white, Asian, Jewish, Hispanic. It doesn't matter. This is supposed to be our country that democracy always prevails, regardless if you like it or not, okay? Right. The power of the vote is the final say,
That's right.
okay? And for them to overthrow this government and kill people and then install their own government and then rewrite the history books, okay, to come out as heroes and then hide it. I mean, that's the most heinous thing that you could do.
Yeah.
Let's keep moving, Double A.
Turn on the news and the state's long history of political suppression echoes.
And we turn to a strict new voter ID law in North Carolina. Racial gerrymandering and a push for new voting maps.
The court says the Republican-led legislature redrew congressional districts along racial lines, violating the Constitution.
There's a tremendous amount of intimidation that is still felt by the Black community.
It doesn't have to be mass mayhem and violence in the streets.
The strategy shifts towards designing state laws in such a way that you could exclude Blacks from voter participation.
The subliminal pursuit of continuing the white Declaration of Independence.
And if you don't see it for what it really is, it can happen all over again.
Man, it's a lot. And unfortunately, when you think about it, you think about it in a vacuum. You think about it as now. You think about it as, well, that's just the way things are and, you know, that kind of stuff. And now understanding the inception of it, the history of it, you look and say, wow, the fact of the gerrymandering and the poll suppression and the Jim Crow-like, you know, taxes, you know, poll taxes and literacy tests and things like, keep in mind, the irony of the literacy test, Tony, you said, and they wrote, that the majority of the white voters were illiterate, which is why they put the stuff in cartoons.
Right.
Then you come back years later or not, well, I guess the next year and put into a system literacy test, which I'm sure that those white folks that was voting didn't learn how to read real quick. There might've been something going on there. I can't put my finger on it, but yeah, they showed up and you just, you know, put them in that situation. I'll tell you a quick story, Tony, please. In 2008, Barack Obama was elected to the presidency, and my grandmother was alive. She died a year later, but she voted. She always voted. I never voted. Even when I got 18, never voted, never really believed in it, all that kind of, or never thought it mattered and all that kind of stuff, but she was big on it. And I asked her, you know, talked to her, sat down with her, how'd you feel about this, you know, and, you know, this, because he got elected, right? He got elected, and he was doing the inauguration and all that. And my grandma's a real stoic, kind of hardcore lady, but she grew up on a hog farm in Missouri. And she burst into tears. And it caught me off guard. Really took me back. It caught me off guard. And she said, it's amazing. I am in disbelief because I can remember she had 12 brothers and sisters. My dad went to vote one time. And they told him, if you don't vote Republican, or if you don't vote Democrat, excuse me, if you don't vote Democrat, then we're going to come and kill you and your family. So after he went against that, just like they did here, the same tactics, right? After we talk about 1930s, right? After he went and voted, he and the family hid out for 2 days, scared for their life because he voted.
Right.
And he voted in the way in which he voted Republican, in the way in which he wanted to vote and was afraid because he had got past all the other limitations that were put in Missouri for this thing. But this, now we talk, Missouri is not North Carolina, South Carolina. It's come this way now. It's spread throughout the entire United States, this type of ideology of we can suppress the vote, we can make it what we want to with intimidation and fear. And I just, that stuck with me because when she said that, she was just so happy that a Black person was now the president of the United States. When she was a child, her father was scared to even vote.
Right. So listen, buddy, real quick, and we're going to move on. Number one, thanks for sharing that story, right? I mean, there you go, right? That speaks to what we're talking about. But let's be fair here, though, right? This didn't start in North Carolina, then moved west, okay? At the end of the day, there's always been political suppression of the Black vote, okay? That's in that, and again, we're talking the South here, but this happens in the North. It happens all over.
That's what the last clip was.
Is that this was 1898 where they came in blasting, all right, and whipping Black people not to vote. And to your point, what you said that happened to your grandmother, right, mm-hmm. in terms of scaring them. But now they're redrawing maps. They're still trying to suppress the Black vote, not through violence, but through all different type of legal means or whatever the case may be. So this stuff still happens. But her clip was, Cynthia Brown's last point was, Look, what did she say here? She said, you got to see it for what it really is because it can happen all over again. So let's do this real quick. Let's recap what we just went through. Okay, so everybody's on the same page, right? So first, this is Wilmington, 1898. First thing, they didn't like it. They didn't like the Fusion Party coming together. Black, white, black people in power. So what did they do? They came up with a plan, right? They got everybody together. They rallied to protest exactly the results. We're going to take this over. We're going to we're not going to be under Negro rule. White man needs to run this country. So they rallied everybody together, got them on the same page to start this plan.
And to get them on the same page, they enacted a strategy, actually had the unmitigated goal to write down, publish, and distribute a strategy, a handbook, the White Declaration of Independence, named it that openly, and made sure that that got into the hands of anybody that could absorb it to help to propagate their agenda.
Exactly. And then what did they do? What did they, how did they propagate this lie? How did they create people, make people afraid that if black people were in charge, they were going to rape their women, they were going to take over, we wouldn't be safe. They used the media, which was the newspaper, right, to get people scared. They used pictures, the whole nine yards, to get the white people that was part of the Fusion Party to get angry, and then they were going to use violence.
And then they downplayed it and rewrote it. They rewrote themselves and cast themselves as heroes, cast themselves as saviors for the American way. You know, and that was probably the most heinous thing because it was able to go undetected to a great degree or unresolved for sure. And that changed the course of our country because they were allowed to rewrite the narrative after they had documented their actual intentions.
Exactly. So now let's go back to what Cynthia Brown said. If you don't see it for what it really is, it can happen all over again. Go ahead, Double A.
They came from all 50 states to protest an election they believed had been stolen.
We're here, Patriots. We're in Washington, D.C., Capitol building dead in front of us.
Their day of action would be January 6th. It was a call to arms.
We have the power in numbers. March on Congress. Directly after Trump's speech.
Sounds like the rally to me. Sounds just like 1898. All right, let's get them together. We got to do this. Let's keep moving, Double A.
In the weeks beforehand, there were over a million mentions on social media of storming the Capitol. Maps were shared of the building's layout. There was talk of bringing weapons and ammunition, and discussion over which lawmakers should be targeted first. This anger was based on a lie.
This election was a fraud.
It wasn't a secret. Now, it wasn't called a handbook. It wasn't called the declaration of anything, but it was not a secret. And they used the publication at the time to make sure that people understood that they were going to go and do something about it. This cannot stand. This is not going to be accepted.
Exactly, right? So they came with their strategy. Keep going, Double A.
A lie that had grown more frenzied after the election.
President Trump won this election.
They were flipping votes.
Steal the election in Philadelphia.
When you win in a landslide and they
steal the election in Atlanta.
And it's rigged.
Steal the election in Milwaukee.
It's not acceptable.
This is outrageous.
A lie spread by the president and his closest allies.
Let's call out cheating when we find it.
Some of whom stoked calls for violence.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow.
Everyone's going to remember who actually stands in the breach and fights tomorrow and who goes running off like a chicken.
We bleed freedom.
This will be their Waterloo.
And we will sacrifice for freedom.
This will be their destruction.
What happened next was chaos.
They broke the glass.
Insurrection.
Take it now!
Treason! Treason!
Death.
Sound like 1898 all over to me, all right? Use the media to propagate the lie, to push the lie out. Use all the individuals. This was stolen. This is it. Get people angry. Get rile them up. okay? Seems like the same thing to me. And then try to overthrow, all right, try to interfere with a free election in terms of electing Biden to be president. Let's hear the next part.
Then there began a campaign to whitewash history, starting at the top.
It was a zero threat. Right from the start, it was zero threat.
And spreading throughout the Republican Party.
Even calling it an insurrection, it wasn't. By and large, it was peaceful protest.
One lawmaker who helped barricade the House doors now suggests there was barely any threat.
If you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit.
A tourist visit? This was not.
It's so disrespectful to the people that died on January 6th that history was trying to be rewritten by these folks, as it's disrespectful to the 60 people plus that died in 1898, that, you know, this was not what it was, that this was not an attempt at a coup. This wasn't successful like 1898, but it had all the earmarkings, right? It had all the time for words had passed. It had the legal ramifications where they said, we're going to go to court and sue and get these votes recounted. And then they went through all of that. And then the courts denied the claims of fraudulent or corrupt behavior. And then it turned to violence. Because when you have someone, democracy was not defeated by the successful insurrection in Wilmington, because the rules of democracy don't apply to people who don't, you know, believe in democracy. And so when you have these people that, when it doesn't go their way, they throw tantrums and kill people and don't believe in the system that we abide by, that we believe in, which is American democracy. And they go and they kill Americans. Keep in mind, we've said all this, but I want you to walk away understanding Americans were killed for exercising their right as Americans and living the American dream. And that's unacceptable, whether it be 1898, 2009, or, you know, 1998, 2024, 2023. It doesn't matter. We can't be okay with they don't go the way I go, therefore they must go.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Right, right. So you heard it. This has happened again, okay? And to Chris's point, it didn't happen to the level of 1898, all right? But it was definitely bubbling up to that. And this is very important. This is why we went over today's episode, okay, is that we want everyone to be aware of these things. These things happen. You know, what the one thing is, right now, our history is under attack. People are trying to keep history from you and myself and everyone else, because when you have history, you have knowledge. And when you have knowledge, the goal is to try to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself. But if you have no knowledge of something, then you wouldn't expect it to ever happen. Well, this happened before, and people were appalled on January 6th, like, oh, this is the first time. But no, it happened before, all right? Chris talked about earlier how people still try to use that game plan in terms of the divide and conquer strategy. So it's very important that everyone stay woke, stay aware of what's going on in your local community, the federal community, everything. Make sure that your local community is teaching history, the whole history, so your kids and yourself can be educated on the good, the bad, and the ugly, so we can make this country not just great, but we can keep it great by learning from our mistakes in the past. So I think it's time now for
Tony's Tidbit.
So today's tidbit is by Warren Buffett, and it epitomizes what we went through today. The tidbit is, what we learn from history is that people don't learn from history. And that's by Warren Buffett. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode, Wilmington's Lie, with my co-host, me and my co-host, Chris P. Reed. I hope you got a lot out of it. I ask you, if you want to learn more, pick up David Cicchino's book, Wilmington's Lie. Excellent book. It'll give you the whole background in terms of what we talked about today. I want to thank my co-host, Chris P. Reed. I also want to thank the person behind the glass, Double A. You can tune in to our next episode of A Black Executive Perspective, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us on all our social channels, LinkedIn, X, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook at A Black Exec. I'm Tony Tidbit. We talked about it. We love you, and we're out.
A Black Executive Perspective.